Chapter 35.
Genesis 35. Now we're getting to very practical. Some of these chapters are just excellent. And we're trying to get, if not two, maybe three chapters done today. We can go fairly fast, especially chapter 36 is basically names. But we'll get on chapter 35 of Genesis. Jacob finally gets home. You'll see in this chapter a great outline of steps that God directs us to take to get back right with God when you've been backslidden or carnal. Very practical. You will also see the cost of being away. You can never go home the same. And the home will never be the same like it could have been if you had stayed right. Two very great, very powerful, very convicting truths. If you ever get away from God, you can always come back to God, but you won't be the same. And the potential that you could have had if you'd stayed right always diminishes. Mm-hmm. Samson is a great illustration of somebody who had great ability given to him by God, but he never accomplished what God designed for him to do. He never did. Yes, he ultimately killed more people in his death than he ever killed in his life, but he could have done so much more. Jacob could have been so much more if he had stayed or had gotten right much earlier and stayed right. So these are great illustrations for us. Let's first talk about getting right with God. Verses 1, 2, 3, 4 of chapter 35. Eric, would you mind reading? Genesis 35, the first four verses.
And God said unto Jacob, Arise, go up to Bethel, and dwell there, and make there an altar unto God that appeared unto thee when thou fleddest from the face of Esau thy brother. Then Jacob said unto his household and to all that were with him, Put away the strange gods that are among you, and be clean, and change your garments. And let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make there an altar unto God, who answered me in the day of my distress, and was with me in the way which I went. And they gave unto Jacob all the strange gods which were in their hand, and all their earrings which were in their ears. And Jacob hid them under the oak which was by Shechem. Verse 5?
Nope. Now, getting back to Bethel, here, this place was named by Abraham, and it means, you've got to remember it, but it means the house of God. It's where God was feared, he was worshipped and honored as God. Bethel was a place where you had the right attitude about God. Both Abraham, Isaac, Jacob now, always when they encountered Bethel, they had their heart right. And they feared God first, they worshipped and they honored him. That's why a church is referred to, and this is very important. When we talk about a church, we talk about a place that is often called the house of God. Now, I know there are a lot of people who have a problem with that phrase. It really bothers me that people sort of find fault with everything. But the word church, okay, when you go to that church and to call it the house of God, people have a problem with that. Now, what could be the problem with calling a church house the house of God? What would be a problem with that?
Sounds like a temple.
A temple, but Bethel wasn't a temple. What could be a problem with it? The problem could be that the church becomes a holy place. Where it is the holy place, where this church house, this church building, is considered a temple. What else could it be considered? What could make that wrong? It overshadows the people. That is a potential problem for a church house, isn't it? All right? But the whole concept of a Bethel is that there has to be a place that maybe you have to get back to. And that place was called, in the Old Testament, the house of God, where God was feared, where people got right, where it was a holy place. And there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, I think, now we have a lot of fun in here, but we do a lot of things in this building. But people should never think of this place, our office, as a place where pornography is ever thought about or looked at or even brought into, where drink is ever brought into, where drugs are ever done, because it's associated with a church. It is supposed to be a holy place. We ought to have times of worship here. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't have times of worship elsewhere. So I just want to want you to understand this physical place called Bethel has a reference that applies to the church. For example, church, the word church, actually, you've got all kinds of times it shows up. You ever see Captain Kirk? But Kirk is a Scottish word for a church. It's kind of funny.
So why South African as well?
Is that South African? Probably because it comes from Dutch or German. That I'm not sure. But Kirk. In Irish, it's kill. So you'll see Kilberry, Kilbritton.
Or just kill itself outside Dublin.
Right. And there's hundreds of kills everywhere. All right. And it sometimes it's just one L, sometimes it's two L's. But the Irish is kill. The newer idol is temple. Have you noticed that? I don't know how it's spelled, if it's spelled any different. T-A, maybe, M-P-L-E. But you'll see in Irish, they'll point to a church and they'll call it a temple, which is weird to me. But anyway, church simply means, when you say church, it means the house of the Lord. And it goes back to the time when there was a house that belonged to the Lord of, or the one person who was in charge of a region, like Blarney was and things. But the principle is this: you don't have to go to a church location to have a Bethel, but you can't have a Bethel experience if you're staying away from church. All right. Somebody says, "Well, I have my own church." Well, fine. Yeah, that means you go fishing, and you have your own church experience. You can get right with God out on the fishing boat, but you can't get right with God if you're staying away from the people of God, and they're assembling together. Notice the term. Forsake not the assembling together, as the manner of some is. All of those people come together. Where are they coming? They're coming to a place. And that place ought to be a Bethel. Does that make sense? Does anybody understand what I'm getting at?
You use the word it says sanctuary of God in Psalm 73. I never hear people use the word sanctuary, but I have heard the word tabernacle, which doesn't seem. What do you think about the word tabernacle as a church name use or whatever?
I have a problem. I have a problem with it being called only a fellowship. I have a problem with it being called a tabernacle and not a church because of the confusion that you can. Because a tabernacle means a tent.
Right. Right?
If you read in Hebrews, it says Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob dwelt in tabernacles. So, okay. So a tabernacle simply means a tent. But now, the tabernacle was a tent where God dwelt amongst the people when they dwelt in tents.
Yeah.
So, when somebody calls something a tabernacle, okay, that's where the church is meeting. Is what they're trying to emphasize is this is a building where the church, the people, meet in that tent, so to speak. That's a really deep concept, whereas church, maybe, it talks about unto the church at, that we're assembling at, and I prefer, it's not that this is wrong, I'm not going to find total fault with it, but I just prefer to have a church, not a fellowship. If I have a fellowship, that'll be at my house. That'll be at Barry's house. Let's go have a fellowship over at Barry's house, all right? Let's go to Marcus's house, have some fellowship. But if you're going to have church, that's a different category, okay? If you're going to have tabernacle, I don't understand what that means. Does that, you understand what I'm saying? Church is much more of a helpful use. Okay? You're going to interrupt. You're going to say something.
I just want to say the word tabernacle just conjures up the tent place where God met with the people.
Yes.
In your mind. And tabernacle really just makes you think of the Old Testament where God first met with them.
Mm-hmm. And when Stephen referred to the people when they were around the tabernacle, he called them the church in the wilderness, not the tabernacle in the wilderness, not just the assembly. All right. Now, sanctuary, again, think of the word sanctuary. Why the word? Here we are debating a lot of side issues, I know. But when we talk about a sanctuary, we're talking about something that is sanctified. Now, that is something that is sanctified ought to be you and me. But again, that place, and I believe it, a place ought to be set apart in the community as that's a church. That's where the church meets, yes. But that is a place that is holy, that is never going to have drink on it. I have been, my church, First Baptist Church of Caldwell, is right next to St. Aloysius Catholic Church. And you know what they do? They have carnivals in there to attract people, and they hand out beer on the Catholic grounds. That would never, ever cross the mind of a Bible believer to hand out alcohol. It ought to be, a church ought to be a sanctuary. It ought to be a place where people feel safe, where it is clean. That place. Now, I know the problem with having the emphasis on a place and de-emphasizing the people. I don't want to ever do. I do want to keep them both holy. I want to keep them both sanctified.
To be the church needs to come together, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So
a building is not the church.
Yeah, but to come together, they have to have a place.
That's it. That's my point. And that place ought to be a Bethel, as we're going to see.
But to a degree, though, it doesn't really matter what they call the place where they meet, so long as it...
I disagree.
Well,
what do you want to call it? Do you want to call it a club?
No, you're not. No, listen.
Okay.
So to a degree, it doesn't matter what you call it. Other than you use words, it's scriptural.
Yeah.
You know, to describe that place where they're meeting.
Like,
if you did call it a tabernacle, okay, we know what it means, really, what it conjures up with the Old Testament, but what we're saying really is it's a place where Bible believers come together to meet with God and worship Him.
What bothers me, and I'll cross over into your territory, and I'm not, and when I say bother, I mean it just befuddles me. The Iron Hall, okay? Incredible place, but you know what they call it? A church still.
Yeah.
All right? But the name doesn't contain the word church. And what I've watched over the last... I don't know, in church history, over the last 60 or 70 years, I've seen people drop their names from Faith Baptist
Church
has now been called Faith, they change it to Faith Bible Church. And then after that, after they have another church split or people get all upset, they change it to just Bible Church. And then you find them, or you find somebody else saying, let's just call ourselves a Bible Fellowship. What's wrong with that? It's de-evolution. It is breaking down. I don't know what that is. All right? And then if it becomes... I don't know how we can go even further, but people do, and they just call it. What am I thinking?
You know, in youth work, they also have this saying that they say, "Don't put label on people. Don't put labels on them. Put those in jars." But you have to label things.
Yes, you do.
Because if you don't label it, then you don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And to label it and give it a name expresses exactly what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we use language to it, and that's why some people are very articulate and can express themselves better than others because they know how to use the language and they understand what the words know mean.
Yeah, there's a church here in Ireland, and they'll call themselves such Fellowship, and then in tiny words it says a Baptist Church. I go, why? Why do that? Why not just call it a Baptist Church? Most large churches, when they were smaller and when they were right with God, they were Baptist. And then when they got bigger, they didn't want to offend anybody, so they dropped the name Baptist, they dropped the name Bible, or they dropped something that was offensive, and they became less and less pinnable. You couldn't pin them and say, that's what their doctrine is. And I don't like that. I don't like that.
Well, so, the Iron Hall didn't start with church.
No, and I'm not attacking the Iron Hall. I'm just saying, they call it the Iron Hall,
yeah,
but they know it's a church.
But they start with it, and everybody in the area knows what the Iron Hall is.
Exactly.
That's for you, exactly, and the Iron Hall. Well, you're a born-again believer.
That's right. Well, they know exactly what the Iron Hall is.
It started off as a gospel hall for men coming from work, and they brought them in, and they just
preached
the gospel at them. That's all it was.
They always call them gospel halls. They don't call them churches.
That's right.
Well, they're essentially, their gospel halls are for outreach. That's what they are. But the gospel hall and
that's
hall,
what they were.
They grew into something bigger. Like the art hall grew from a gospel hall, and it was made out of the corrugated steel sheets of iron. That's what it was made from. That's why I got the name Iron Hall.
Mm.
And then obviously they knocked that down and rebuilt it with brick, and they left the name Iron Hall because everybody called it the Iron Hall in the area. Yes. That's how it stuck. But they never put the Iron Hall Church. They might have put church on there.
They might. I don't know. I've never seen it.
It's just.
I know that everybody calls it,
but in bold,
the Iron Hall Church. Even though it doesn't
have Iron Hall, because where we come from, we know what that means.
Yeah.
It means this is a fundamentalist King James only church.
Mm.
You say Iron Hall, people know right away.
Yep. And again, I don't really find too much fault. A hall is a place where. I come from America. A hall is a walkaway. You know, you walk through a hall. But in Ireland and in Europe, a hall is a meeting place. And again, that's what you're calling it, a meeting place. The difference is, in the, you know, they called it the upper room. Oh, that's it. They'll call it the upper room.
Yeah.
And I go to the upper room. And you go, okay, all right, since I know the Bible, I know what that is.
But others don't.
That's right. But every time it's always called the church. And if you call it the upper room, where the church meets... Okay, it just gets really complicated.
Well, I think part of the reason for that was, though, it was upstairs. they rented it was upstairs.
No, that's fine. That's exactly fine. But when you
play on words,
it is. All right. Enough getting in trouble here. All right, so number two. He says, first of all, get back to Bethel. That is a command by God. God says to Jacob, get up, go to Bethel. How far were they from Bethel? About 15 miles. He had not gotten back to Bethel. Number two. Put away your idols. Now, your 2 Corinthians 6:16 says, what fellowship has idols with Christ? It doesn't have any fellowship. It doesn't have anything to do with it. Now, here is the Father's responsibility. When I make it a capital F, it should be all capitals. It's the parent, the dad's responsibility to make sure this takes place. He says to Jacob, he says, make an altar. And verse 2 says, then Jacob says to his household and all that are with him, put away the strange gods that are among you. I get told probably at least once a month, Pastor, you're not positive enough. And I go, I know, I want to be more positive with my preaching, but I have to tell you, put away idols. Sometimes I just see what has to be exposed, just like Jacob does
what
here.
What do you mean they want to be not positive enough?
Well, they just want to be uplifted, you know. Just somebody comes invariably. I say once a month, maybe once every 2 months or something. Somebody will say, "You're just not very positive in your preach." I'm pretty positive a lot.
I think if you're challenged and you come away, that's positive.
Agreed. I know. Just some people just are beat up by a world, and then they come to church and they want to be lifted up. And you're like, I do my best, and I want to be more positive. But first thing you see here, Jacob says, "Put away the idols that were in his own home, that were among his own family." And he puts away all idols. I have so many scriptures, we don't have time here, where it's not just put away an idol, but make sure you do some digging and some exploring and find out where you are committing spiritual adultery, which is idolatry. Strange gods. Why would they be called strange gods? I love that term, like a strange woman. I think all women are strange. But when it says strange gods, John, what is it? Why does he use the word strange?
I guess they're gods that they're supposed to be foreign to them. They're not supposed to be at home with them.
Excellent. So there's only one God, all right? There is the God I'm familiar with, God I know, the true God, all right? And all other gods are foreign. All other gods ought to be strange to me, just as the one woman I know, the my true wife, all other women are supposed to be strange to me. They're supposed to be foreign, without reach.
I think it means you're not to know them.
No, you're not. No, especially not intimately.
You might know often, but you're not to know them.
And I found it true when I've studied, and when I go into studying rock music, or you start studying cults, you got to pull back because I don't want to know all the details and stuff like that. That's too intimate. Number three, get clean. He tells them to get clean, take a bath, wash yourself. Now, that's personal hygiene. I think it's kind of crazy, that people don't respect their bodies. And you know, if somebody doesn't comb their hair, doesn't find it that they can wear a tie, that they don't know how to dress up and don't know how to look proper for work or for church, that means something's wrong with their heart too. All right. When you dress down and you're just junky, that tells me a lot about somebody's character. They don't respect themselves. And so God says, respect yourself, take a bath, clean up for church. It ought to be something you do, and you dress up for church. So it's get clean, it's also spiritual.
Kind of an outward sign of respect as well. This is serious, this is something I respect greatly. That's why I change and look different.
That's right.
And it's a sign of what's on the inside as opposed to...
If you got to meet, I worked in a telephone company that had 300,000 employees in AT&T, in the telephone company. In my division, which was it's called Bell Laboratories, in my division, there was the head of the division, and the division had 50,000 employees in it. But he, the manager of our division, worked in the same office that I worked in. And the same office I worked in had 5,000 employees in it. It was a massive, there were actually four buildings, if you can imagine, a building, and a building, and a building, and a building. I think they were 7 floors high, all encased in glass. And there were 5,000 employees in that building. So if you could just imagine in this structure. All encased in glass. All right? So 7-story buildings. 4 7-story buildings. He worked in those buildings. Well, one day I was passing underneath an overhang, because there were walkways between each of these. All right? When I passed from one building to another building, I looked up, and I'm sort of, I don't know, I was carrying some equipment, or I looked up, and I saw, we had pictures, we knew what he looked like, never met him. And I looked up, and he's looking down at me, watching me, and I immediately stretched up. I don't know if I'd ever meet him again, but I straightened up, I smiled at him, and I just kept on walking. Why would I do that? I respected him. And I knew that he was watching me, and I straightened up, and I said, boy, if I ever had to face him, I want him to think highly of me.
You also fear there was or not?
There was great fear. I said, man, I hope I'm not doing anything stupid, you know, picking my nose or whatever. Okay, the point is, when we come before God, shouldn't we be aware of he's noticing me? I should think highly of myself. That's why they had to get ring. And that's why we have a quiet time. That's why we spend time in prayer and spend time in our Bible, because we worry about being clean. Jesus said in John 15:3, now are ye clean through the word which I have spoken unto you.
Can I digress or go back a little bit? It's always been an issue about how we dress and suggest that we should wear. The culture, well, first of all, why do we should we wear shirt and ties? Why can't we just wear something that's smart? Funny, I was reading something about Cloud the other night, last night, actually, and prompted something. But anyway, even denims, like, cost, not these type of clothes, cheap ones, but there's denims that are extremely expensive, and they're very smart today as well. The whole culture and the fashion has changed. Even with the suit and tie, the tie has gone an awful lot. When I was back in the North, I thought it was bizarre. I didn't know ties on its way out now. So they wore the shirt and tie, even the three-piece suit with just a tie open in one colour, and that's the way they're wearing them. So the fashion changes. Should we set standards that we set for ourselves, or what is it?
Okay, so you're asking the right question.
Yeah, but the culture again too is, and I've noticed here, especially that the tracksuit has gone almost, but there's still those who are still in tracksuit. They spend a fortune. Some of those tracksuits cost £100, and they wear them slightly. I'm not getting the effect of wearing a tracksuit. Yet you're not allowed into clubs and tracksuits and denims, because they tend to think that you don't mind getting into a fight unless you're wearing a suit.
So,
but there are still the individuals who wear tracksuits and they feel and they walk really smart in them, but it doesn't look the same as a suit.
And I don't know if they actually do. Why is it that guys who are doing drugs and guys who are hanging around with people who do drugs wear the tracksuit? Why is it they have to wear their hoodie halfway up their cranium cap and leave it there?
It looks like an elf.
It looks like a dweeb. I don't know. But who's influencing who? When the world is influencing Christians, we've lost. Okay? So, not, but our style, our fashion, or especially, and not by the outward plaiting of hair, wearing of gold, putting on of apparel, but by the inward man. But the inner man of the heart affects the outer man, which affects the world. So, sometimes people only focus on the outer man, how to dress, Well, you first start here. Then you talk about, yeah, a guy should. As a matter of fact, when the Titanic was being worked on, you never saw a single man who didn't wear a tie, tweed jacket. Here they are welding, but they wear suits. And they just so respected their job, respected themselves, that every man wore a suit.
But that was in a sense all that some of those people had. That's what they wore in those days. That was the working clothes.
I understand, you know? But they had self-respect enough. They were wearing ties. They were wearing suits. They weren't wearing, you know, dingy, poor man's clothes. And I'm just trying to say that the Christian, one Christian can be a light and can affect the fashion around. One of our teenage girls can be so in love with God that when she wears a dress, the other girls say, I need to get a dress. One can do that. But also, one bad attitude Christian who says, I'm never wearing another dress, can so influence all the other Christian girls, so they jump
the dress. Barry said that the other day.
Amen.
You're never wearing a dress again.
Amen. Good. So I hope not. Okay. So let's go on.
Did you read what Cloud wrote about Blackie?
I did.
Did you read the word said talking about the style of dress and the issues and why you should dress and questions you should ask yourself?
That's very, very good.
Did you? Yeah. Yes. That's just why I brought that
up. No, it's very, very good. I try to just not go too far on the side issues. Okay. But he does tell them in chapter 35, he says, change your garments, change your clothes, because you're going to the house of God. You're going to church. You're going to worship. Number four, make an altar. Make an altar is your fill-in for number four. That's a place where you kill some things. I really, really want to preach this on a Sunday where I say, all right, when you came to church today, I hope you came willing to crucify some anger this morning. Crucify some bitterness. I wish that we had a concept of I'm going and I'm going to make an altar this morning where I'm going to put something up there and I'm going to burn it out. I'm going to kill it so it doesn't go home with me. Right? It could be pornography. It could be lust. It could be depression. But you mortify it. Hmm?
Is that Romans 12:1?
Yep.
Present your bodies a living sacrifice.
Amen. But that, I know, but I'm
but
talking
you're
about
sacrificing
anything that's physical, right?
But if you sacrifice, there's things you have to kill.
Amen. 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 And number five, bury the past. Did you notice what he did? And I've always thought this was kind of funny, but he verse four, he took all of their gods in verse four, and he hid them under the oak. He buried them under an oak tree. So it's to bury the past, you know. Why didn't he burn them? I don't know, but I think he gives an illustration that, you know, this stuff I may never be able to get rid of the scars and get rid of the memories, but I can bury them. I can put these things away and never dig them up again. And I think a lot of Christians go back to where they have a sin and they dig it back up and says, I missed you. And it's wrong. All right, number B. Let's look at God's presence there. Romeo, what did you read? Verse 5.
Romans.
No, we're in Genesis 35:5.
And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob.
Wow. The reason why all of that. Now, why would they? Romeo, why would they even think about pursuing after Jacob and his sons? Do you remember what happened last week?
He didn't go to the Bethel, he was going to Shechem, and he was doing things on his own.
Right, and he ended up killing everybody in there.
Yeah, his sons killing everybody. Like,
And he could have, that could have created a war. But there's only one thing that kept all the other villages from attacking Jacob. What was the one thing that was protecting Jacob? According to that verse.
Maybe the God was...
Only God. Says because...
God is protecting him because...
That's it. The only reason why we're not dead this morning is because God has protected us on the road and everywhere else. Amen. So God's presence was there. Number C, Jacob's altar, 6 to 8 there, John.
So Jacob came to Luz, which is in the land of Canaan, that is Bethel, he and all the people that were with him. And he built there an altar and called the place El Bethel, because there God appeared unto him when he fled from the face of his brother. But Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried beneath Bethel under an oak, and the name of it was called Alon Bethel.
Okay. He said it so well because he did Hebrew. It's not fair. Alright, number one, Jacob did what he's finally doing what God commanded him to do. He called it after God instead of just the house of God. So, Bethel means what, John?
House of God.
Alright. And when you put an L in front of it, what happens to it? So you got Bethel. This is house of God. With the L there. And he put L in front of it. And what did he do? What did he make the name now? It's God of the house of God. So he's finally changed from physical house, physical altar, physical traditions, rituals to the God of the house of Jacob. So he's elevated his own relationship with God, where it's the God of the house of Jacob, of the house of Beth, of the house of God, kind of a layer upon layer. And it was here also that Rebecca's nurse Deborah dies, and she's buried under an oak. Now, anybody got a guess? Barry, I figure, might have a guess. What's the importance of the oak tree in the Bible? Why oak? Because there are a couple of agreements. There's at least one agreement that they make under an oak. There's a time where, there's several times you see right here where they're burying things under an oak. And still to this day in America, in the old days, when they came to a community, they would always, there was always an oak tree where decisions were made. People would meet around the oak tree. The oak tree was something where people would go and they would sign contracts or whatever. For some unknown reason, they honor an oak tree. And I don't know what it is. Okay, so I thought Mary would know that off the top of his head. But anyway, alright, so number D. God has some blessings. Back to you, Barry, 9 to 15.
And God appeared unto Jacob again when he came out of Padan Aram and blessed him. And God said unto him, thy name is Jacob. Thy name shall not be called any more Jacob, but Israel shall be thy name. And he called his name Israel. And God said unto him, I am God Almighty. Be fruitful and multiply. A nation and a company of nations shall be of thee, and kings shall come out of thy loins. And the land which I gave Abraham and Isaac to thee, I will give it, and to thy seed after thee will I give the land. And God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. And Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, even a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering thereon, and he poured oil thereon. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spake with him, Bethel.
All right, so, first of all, the great blessing that I list is God shows up. Now that may not be much to you, but when you have church, it's nice when John's there, when Barry's there, it's even nice when Eric's there. But it's best when God's there. So here, God finally appears back to Jacob. And a second blessing that God gives Jacob is that changed name should now mean a changed life. See, God changed his name before he was able to change his life.
Changed life.
A changed life. God had changed his name, but now he sees that God has changed his life. Number three, he announced the source of the change was the I am. He keeps reminding us, says, I am, I am. I am your, I am the God Almighty. And he commanded a blessing. He commanded a blessing first on his family. He told them, be fruitful and multiply. You're going to have lots of children. Here's a man who's already got 13 children. He says, you're going to have a lot more. But they're going to be grandchildren. B, he says, a nation is waiting to be born of you if you just believe it. C, he says, even kings shall come of you. I've read people who say that Israel was never supposed to have a king. Well, that's stupid. Kings, plural, would be of you, he says. So number C is your fill-in is king, so come of you. And number D, was David supposed to be a king in Israel? David was supposed to be. Just Saul was gotten too early. You and your children will inherit the promised land, and these would be resurrection verses. Kind of funny how he says there, let me show you this. Look in the land, verse 12. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, to who will I give it?
Jacob.
Wait a minute, Jacob's going to die before it ever becomes his land, isn't it?
Yeah.
Here's a resurrection verse. He says, to you I'm going to give this land. And he never gets it in his life, so Jacob has to be resurrected to get that land. So it's a resurrection verse. Number five, God, not just the angel, visibly went up. Look in verse 13, it says, and God went up from him. Why doesn't it say the angel? Because it is the appearance of God in the form of an angel. God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. Number six, Jacob made a special place of remembrance, made it with a pillar. He poured wine, which was a drink offering, and I don't believe it was alcoholic. He poured oil on it. And when you've seen Melchizedek, what does he bring when he worships with Abraham? He brings a oil and a wine, not a wine and
bread.
A bread offering.
Hmm? Bread and wine, was it? Melchizedek?
Go back to chapter 17, 18. Where is it? Is it bread and wine? I think it's oil and wine.
Chapter 14.
Is it 14?
Verse 18.
And Melchizedek brought forth bread and wine. I apologize. I don't know why. I thought it was just oil and wine. Okay. Well.
What was it? What was
Genesis 14, 18. And I had it as a wine and an oil. I thought it was bread. Some things I don't check. I apologize.
There's no connection between Melchizedek.
No, it's not that. It's that worship. The connection is with worship. Sometimes it's bread and wine, evidently, and sometimes it's oil and wine. It's not particular as only one pattern in the whole thing, evidently. And then Jacob keeps calling the place Bethel. As if to say, wow, this is Bethel, this is Bethel. And I remember when I first got saved, and I hope you never lose the desire and the zeal. You say, man, this is church. Wow, this is great. I love Sundays. So he just keeps calling. Even when he makes this new altar, he calls it Bethel again. In principle, everywhere that God speaks to you and blesses you ought to be your Bethel. So you ought to have a Bethel beside your bed or where you read your Bible. You want to have a Bethel spot at the park. Number E. Now there's some bittersweet events, verses 16 through 20, Eric.
Sorry, we're talking about 16 to 20?
Yes, sir.
And they journeyed from Bethel, and there was but a little way to come to Ephrath.
Ephrath.
Ephrath. Thank you, that. And Rachel travailed, and she had hard labor. And it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said unto her, fear not, thou shalt have this son also. And it came to pass, as her soul was in departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, but his father called him Benjamin. And Rachel died, and was buried in the way of Ephrath, which is Bethlehem. And Jacob set a pillar upon her grave, that is the pillar of Rachel's grave unto this day.
Wow. Alright, here you got Rachel, she delivers a baby. It's hard labor. It was very dangerous. They did not have C-sections back then. So she names her son Benoni. B-E-N-O-N-I, which means the son of my sorrow. I mean, that's sad.
Benoni.
Benoni.
Spelling?
B-E-N.
B-E-N.
B-E-N-O-N-I.
B-E-N-I. We know now. Okay.
But Jacob jumps in and says, no, we're not going down that path. This is a good... Again, who's just died? What kind of relationship did Jacob and Rebecca have?
Married. Wife.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Rachel. Not just marriage, because he's also married to Leah. He's also married to Bella and Zilpah. But what kind of relationship did he and Rachel have?
Must have been a head-racking one with all those wives.
Come on, get better with me. This was his favorite wife. This was the closest of relationships. This should have been the most sorrowful experience of his life, to lose his wife in childbirth. And she names the boy the son of my sorrow. And it would have been easy for him to say, yes, this, from now on, I want my son to live with this name. He is the son of our sorrow. Your mother died having you. Can you imagine being reminded of that all your life? But he says, no, this is the son of my right hand. This is the strength. He's 130 years old, and he's got a new boy, and he calls him my strength. So this is a man who's still got some faith, and he's got some encouragement. So he renames. So your C is Benjamin, which is the son of my right hand, the strength at my right hand. Now, number two, Rachel's death. Let's go to Micah also. You notice that word Ephrath? Let's go to Micah, where we see the Christmas verse, the verse that predicts the birth of Jesus. In the Minor Prophets, just before Matthew, find Micah, chapter 5, verse 2. Spelling's
different than that one?
Hey?
Spelling's different?
The spelling's different, but only because of time. They pronounced it differently, and I'll talk about it in a minute, but read verse 2.
But thou, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though thou be little among thousands of Judah, yet out of thee shall come forth unto me, that is, to be ruler in Israel, whose goings forth have been from of old, from everlasting.
All right, so Bethlehem, Ephrathah. It's like saying... Killarney, Kerry. Kerry is the region. Killarney is the town. Bethlehem's the village. Ephrath is the area. So when Rachel dies, she dies in an area called Ephrath. Guess where David goes, where Jesus comes from, is, even though Bethlehem is a little place, Rachel seems to be particular. She dies there, and that's where Jesus is going to be born. And if you would, you look at verse 3, and look at how verse 3 reminds you and connects to a prophecy that goes back to her birth, to her death, sorry.
Therefore will he give them up until the time that she which travaileth hath brought forth. Then the remnant of his brethren shall return unto the children of Israel.
Wow, so here's somebody trying to bring forth a child, but this bringing forth of a child has got 30 cross references. One of them is in Revelation chapter 12. Where a woman gives birth to a child and restores the nation of Israel. And that's Jesus. So, she which travaileth hath brought forth is referring to Rachel in the past and to a future event all throughout the Minor Prophets of the birth of the nation of Israel again, which we've seen the beginnings of the birth. We've seen actually the birth in 1948. So, alright.
Jesus is the Son of God, so yeah, isn't he?
Exactly. Not an angel. He's the son of my right hand. Okay, so this is also the same place that Naomi comes from and returns to in the book of Ruth. Ruth goes back to Ephrath and to Bethlehem. The last part of Jacob's old life was now dead and gone. Wait a minute. His love of his life was Rachel. Who's left? Just his kids and God. So his old life is now finally dead. The last part of his old life has been...
The rest of his life are dead, look.
Buried. Well, listen, Leah's still alive. But in his old life, his choices that he made before he got converted were Rachel, weren't they? Laban. It was for possessions. It was his health. All that was him before his light. Now, not the consequences. He lives with the consequences. Leah's a consequence. Bill is a consequence. Zilpah's a consequence. His children are a consequence. But his wife is now gone. And now he has to look forward. And he does very well. So Jacob and his family, verse 21 to 26, Romeo, back in Genesis 35.
Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the tower of Eder. And it happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay at Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Paddan Aram.
You're going down just to 26. Good. So here you've got some birth order and wife order as ordered by God. Who's the first wife listed? It's not Rachel. It's Leah and her children. So God honored, even though Jacob was tricked by Laban, Leah was the first wife, and God honors her and puts her first and her children first, even though Rachel was Jacob's favorite. So your child that you get as your child, your wife that you got is your wife. Okay? Don't be so quick to replace her.
Sorry, what did you say there again? That Leah was actually the first wife in God. Which are first to hear?
She's the first wife, but it's not the wife that he wanted.
Yeah. I thought that's what you're saying.
Yes. And so God honors and puts her first. These are the sons of Jacob, and he lists Leah's children first. So he lists Reuben. And remember, every time you saw Reuben, and you said, "Hey, Reuben," you were saying, "Behold, a son." When he called for Simeon, it means hearing. Levi, joined, or like a mediator. Judah meant praise. Issachar means God's hears me. Zebulun, dwelling or at rest, never frantic. Dinah is also in there, but she's not a son, but I just wanted to put her in the list with Leah. Rachel has two children, Joseph, which means adding, or this is just the beginning, and then Benjamin, son of my right hand. Bilhah has got two children, Dan and Naphtali. Zilpah's got two children, Gad and Asher. And then coming all the way home. He's come to Bethel. Now he can come home. Verse 27 to 29, John.
And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac sojourned. And the days of Isaac were 104 years. And Isaac gave up the ghost and died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him.
Unbelievable. 180 years. So back to the area that Abraham and Isaac spent most of the time sojourning, living, the city of Arba. Mamre is where Abraham purchased that cave for their burial. And he's also in the area of Hebron. Now, Isaac lived to be 180 years. He actually lived longer than Abraham. How long did Abraham live, Barry?
175.
And Isaac lives to be 180. Both Esau and Jacob were home to bury their daddy, also in the cave of Machpelah. Now let's go to chapter 36.
One son did Abraham.
No, number two, Isaac lived 180. Abraham lived to be 175. Isaac lived to be 180. Now we're in Genesis chapter 36. Can we quickly go through this Esau's family? Look at verse 31. These are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. So, as you will notice, the world always excels and always does better than God's people. They make more money faster. They accomplish things. They get ahead. They get their kings. They get government. while God's people are still running around in a tent. It doesn't matter. Even if you're in an estate and other people are getting better cars, better jobs, if you stay right with God, you're not going to be at the forefront. People want to get saved for the benefits instead of for forgiveness, instead of for the life. And that's the wrong reason. Here, Esau's family gets ahead. They get the kings, they get the rulers, they get the land, they conquer, while God's people run around still living in tents.
But it's the value of what you put on, what you have.
Yes.
Because in the New Testament terms, it's that godliness, that contentment, it's a great gain.
Yes, sir. Yes, but you're dealing with people who are carnal, looking at, yeah, well, my friends have got better jobs than me because they work on Sunday. Don't worry about them. Let them go ahead because they'll burn out. And then they'll lose their families and they'll lose their health. All right, so less introduction. Here we have the dukes and kings of Edom and all the surrounding areas being listed long before kings show up in Israel. It's actually 1,000 years before King Saul. How did Moses know there would be kings in Israel? Isn't that kind of funny? Why would Moses write there and say these were before there were kings in Israel? Because he knew there would be. Moses wrote down instructions on what kind of king Israel was going to have there in Deuteronomy 17. God promised Jacob that kings would come from the Lord. So that's all. He's just believing the prophecies. Now here, study lesson here. Esau is, look at chapter 36, verse 1. Now these are the generations of Esau. Who is who?
Edom.
All right. So, your first fill in there is Edom. E-D-O-M. E-D-O-M. This is the people of Edom were like their founding father, Esau. So, when we talk about the Jews, who's the founding father of the Jews?
Abraham.
Who was Abraham's father? Terah. Is it T-E-R-A-H? They're not Terahites, are they?
No.
All right. So, Abraham's the founding father of the Jews. Who's the founding father of the Edomites?
Esau.
All right. Isn't that funny? Esau is not following Abraham. Esau is producing the Edomites. That's their founding father. He's known as Edom, and we're going to see why in just a minute. Edom, this is an Edomite was somebody that was rebellious, angry, never concerned about spiritual things, haters of Israel and Jacob, anybody connected with Jacob. That's who the Edomites became known as, because that's who their founding father was known as. Jesus said, ye are of your father the
devil,
and the lusts, the nature of your father, you will have, the lust ye will do. So whatever he was focused on is what you will focus on. Whatever he's focused on, you will focus on. Now, it doesn't follow through perfectly, but you know, my kids ought to be a little bit like me in my relationship with God, just like I'm supposed to be a little bit like my Heavenly Father.
That's quite interesting. Just not to go away into it, but it's the same with Muslims. Because they're based upon the perfect man, which is Muhammad. So what he was focused on, this is what they're focused on.
That's right.
And doing what they're doing.
I think, who told me, they only have 20 names. Everybody's called up to 20 names. Always Muhammad. It's always just one of these series of names that's in that sequence of his children, what he named his kids and named his wives and caliphs and all this stuff. And I would be curious whether they have more names than just 20 names among the Muslims.
I thought there was only 100 you could pick from.
I don't know.
Maybe I'm wrong.
Maybe 100. I thought I heard 20.
But I haven't said that one of the Norwegians are...
Because they focused that on his family, saying that's the perfect list.
One of the Scandinavian countries that was in the paper recently is that it's something 300 names or 500 names. That's all you would pick from. If you have something special like Barry, then you've got to write and get permission.
Yeah.
And you may not get permission because they don't want to lose the Nordic sense.
Maybe so. Mm. Now Esau has how many wives? Look at this, verse 2. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibama, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibeon, the Hivite, and Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nabijah. You've got five women there. You got Adah, Aholibama, Bashemath, Also, Genesis 26, verse 34 says, Judith, the daughter of Beri, she's picked up along the way. Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, there he comes in there in Genesis chapter 28. And none of them was of his own people, group, or nationality. He intermarries with other nationalities. Then he's got verse 3 says, and Bathsheba the Ishmael. Okay, so verse 4, let's look at the descendants.
What's the good ending one?
5.
What?
He's got 5 wives of Esau. And he's got some descendants here. Let me just read these for time. Verse 4 says, and Adah bare to Esau Eliphaz, Bashemath bare Ruel, and Aholah Bama bare Jerish, and Jalem, and Korah. These were the sons of Esau, which were born unto him in the land of Canaan. Esau took his wives, and his sons, and his daughters, and all the persons of his house, and his cattle, and all his beasts, and all his substance, which he had got in the land of Canaan. And he went into the country from whence, from the face of his brother Jacob. So where does he go? Anywhere away from Jacob. Even though he doesn't want to kill him anymore, he doesn't want to be around him. For their riches were more than they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. I would rather have good company than my wealth. Thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir, and he repeats himself, Esau is Edom. These were the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites, in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Adah, the wife of Esau. Reu, the son of Bathsheba, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son. She bare to Eliphaz Amalek. Circle that. These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. And these are the sons of Reuel. Nahath, and Zerah, and Shammah, and Mizah. These were the sons of Bathsheba, Esau's wife. These were the sons of Aholabama, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibion, Esau's wife, and she bare to Esau Jeush, and Jalem, and Korah. These were, now here's your first word, dukes of the sons of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Teman, Duke Omar, Duke Zephar, Duke Kenaz. Notice those names now, those sons have become dukes. Duke Korah, Duke Gatam, and Duke Amalek. These are the dukes that came of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. These were the sons of Adah. These are the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, Duke Nahath, and Duke Zerah, and Duke Shammah, Duke Mizah. These are the dukes that came of Reuel, the son of Edom. These are the sons of Bathsheba, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Aholibama, Esau's wife, Duke Jeush, Duke Jalem, Duke Korah. These were the dukes that came of Aholibama, the daughter of Anna, Esau's wife. These are the sons of Esau, who is? He repeats this over and over, and these are their dukes. Now, you have 3 wives, 13 children coming directly from Esau, and you got these guys. I want you to notice the Amalekites. This is a very bad line. God says to wipe them out. Now, all of these are dukes. When you see the word duke, it just means leader. All right?
But
is that how you spell sheik?
The word H after the
S-H. Oh, is there an H after the K?
No.
S-H.
That's
chic. Anyway, so we're going to ask?
No, I was going to say that there are different levels within the English lineage.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain level. So is that really what it's getting at then?
Well, dukes is the Latin word for leader. In Arabic, it was a sheik. It meant the head of a tribe, just like Isaac had Jacob, and Jacob had 12 tribes. So you had Zebulun, you had Judah. Each one was a leader, the head of their tribe. But these guys had a title. They were leaders, the beginnings of their tribes. Okay? Mm-hmm. So just like Jacob had 12 sons, didn't he? Did Jacob have 12 sons?
Yep.
All right, and each son became the head of a tribe that was specific to that tribe. So you had the tribe of Jacob. What other tribes did you... I'm sorry, you had the tribe of Judah. What other tribes did you have?
Benjamin.
Yeah, Benjamin. What else?
Zebulun.
Levi. Zebulun. All right. So these are all, but they're never given a title. They're just the heads of, you know, a zillion people under each one of them. Okay? Well, the same thing. So all of these are of Israel. Well, Esau, which is Edom, has his sons. And each son, you know, the Amalekites. Who else? Reuel, Korah. All of these are dukes because they organize themselves. These guys are on. There was no king in Israel, so every man did that which was right in their own eyes. But under Esau's family, they organized themselves into a government with people that had power and authority. So now, so
I was struggling, you see, with the lineage as the king, the queen, the princes, the dukes. But actually, the great iPhone and Webster's Dictionary says that when the English or the King James was being written, the word duke was not actually used then. So, and then it says that duke was not used as a title in England when they were writing the King James. So I was thinking duke as in the Duke of North.
Oh.
So that's, I was, I just wonder, how does that equate like that? But then further on, does it says General Forces Dux, which is the Latin.
For leader.
Yeah. And chieftains and so on. I get you. No, that's why I was struggling. What is he talking about?
Okay, now look at how Canaan has influence. In verse 20, Canaan already was very advanced politically and sinfully as well. There were seven dukes of Seir. Esau used to live where? Where did Esau used to live, and where did he get all his wealth? Well, the land of Canaan first. He's moved to Seir, and there in Seir there already are dukes. So his people have adapted to the government and the culture of the land. God's people are not supposed to adapt to the culture of the land. The reason why Israel wanted to have a king so soon before King David is because they looked at all the nations around them and said, everybody's got kings and we don't. And that's what Esau did. Esau adapted to the previous culture that they had just conquered called the Seir people. I don't know why, Seirites or whatever. But look at verse 20. These are the sons of Seir, the Horite. Now the Horite was a Canaanite. Esau was not a Canaanite, was he? Esau was of Abraham. But these are the Canaanites. So these are the sons of Seir, the Horite, that inhabited that land. Lotan, Shobai, Shobal, and Zibeon, and Anna, and Dishon, and Ezer, and Dishan. These are the dukes. So where did Esau get his term for dukes? From the Canaanites that already were there. So Esau is copying Seir.
I want to just make it same.
He's copying the world. Israel, on their own. They have their own culture. Give me an example of people who stand out, still to this day, who stand out, even though they're in a culture, they still stand out from those around them. You ever hear of the Amish? In America? Mm-hmm. You ever seen? All right. They have their own culture. They don't normally have electricity. They still have a horse-drawn carriage. They have great work ethic, and yet they're in a very advanced, civilized community. Who else?
Travelers.
Excellent. They're travelers. Who else?
Muslims.
Yeah, they're kind of in the middle. They're kind of, they do adapt until they get in power, and then they go back.
Yeah, they change the whole culture.
All right, but notice, God's people are supposed to be out of step. They're supposed to be out of step with the world. We're not supposed to take on all the characteristics of the culture that we're in. We got to be careful about that. So we keep going here. We got these leaders here. Verse 22, and the children of Lotan were Hort and Heman. And Lotan's sister was Timnah, The children of Shobal were these, Alvin and Manahath and Ebal and Shephel and Onem. And these are the children of Zibeon, both Aja and Anna. This was that Anna that found the mules in the wilderness as he fed the asses of Zibeon, his father. Must have been a very famous story that everybody told each other. And the children of Anna were these, Dishon and Aholibama, the daughter of Anna. These are the show. Aholibama, she was a very important woman that Esau married. And you see some of these names that are mixing from the Seirites now being part of Edomites. These are the children of Dishon, Hemdan, and Eshban, and Ithran, and Keran. The children of Ezer are these, Bilhan, and Zavan, and Akan. The children of Dishan are these, Uz, and Aran. These are the dukes that came of the Horites, the Canaanites, Duke Lotan, and he labels them all now, makes them dukes. Duke Chobal, Duke Zibeon, Duke Anna. Now again, when Jesus was written, it was written by who? Moses, and he's writing it for the Israelites so that they know who they're dealing with. So when they deal with the people of the Duke of Zibeon, the Duke Anna, they know, oh, these guys are Edomites. Stay away from them. 30, Duke Dishon, Duke Ezer, Duke Dishan. These are the dukes that came of Horai among the dukes in the land of Seir. These are the kings. Now we move up to the kings that reign in the land of Edom, before there reigned any king over the children of Israel. And Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dibnabah. And Bela died. And Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his stead. And Jobab died. And Husham of the land of Temani reigned in his stead. And Husham died. And Hadad, the son of Bedad, who smote Midian in the field of Moab, reigned in his stead. And the name of his city was Abath. And Hadad died. And Shammah, is that and Samla of Masrekah reigned in his stead, and Shamla died, and Saul of Rehoboth by the river reigned in his stead. Saul died. And Baal Hanan, the son of Achbor, reigned in his stead, and Baal Hanan, the son of Achbor, died. And Hadar reigned in his stead, and the name of his city was Pael. And his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezehab. These are the names of the dukes that came of Esau according to their families. Duke Timnah, Duke Alva, Duke Jareth, Duke Aholabama, Duke Elah, Duke Pinnan, Duke Kenaz, Duke Teman, Duke Mibzar, Duke Migdiel, Duke Aram. These be the dukes of Edom according to their habitations in the land of their possession. He is Esau, the father of the Edomites. Fourth time to remind us of that.
Were all those names on the test?
Nope. But here's the thing that's in the test. All right. The first thing is, where did Edom get his culture? From his family and from his God, his father's God, or from his culture that he moved into? Right, it's an obvious answer. But that's Edom adapts, and Edom becomes very powerful. You wonder, why are all those names? So that Israel, and Moses has recorded all this, so that when you met a descendant of one of these things, you'd realize, this is somebody very dangerous. Just like if you met an Amalekite. If you met an Amalekite, what do you know about the Amalekites?
They're bad,
right? They are the jihadists of jihads, okay? They are the baddest of the bad. Yeah. And you stay away from them. And when you met these descendants, if you found out somebody was of this lineage, you go, thanks, have a nice day, I'll go somewhere else. That was why all those names are in there, so that the people of Israel would know not to have anything to do with them.
They followed the own culture or followed the gods?
Okay, Esau was both Israel or Jacob, and Esau was of the same father. What was their father's name? Isaac. And Isaac was Abraham. Was of Abraham, correct? So Esau should have believed in Isaac and Abraham's God, correct? He should have followed
Abraham and Isaac is God, but Esau is in rebellion. And he seeks Canaanite culture and gods. Okay?
So Esau should have, but he didn't. His bitterness kept him from believing the God of Abraham.
Are there any whites still living, or are they all wiped out?
I think they're all wiped out. I think as a people group, they're in the area where Jordan is now, in south of Jordan. What's south of Jordan? Hold on. The area that's south of Israel is what? What is the area south of Israel? Isn't that Jordan?
Syria?
Is Syria south of Israel?
No, it's not.
Syria's north, yeah, so...
Underneath just the Gulf of Aqaba, and then
No. Before you get to the Gulf of Aqaba. I mean, the Gulf of Aqaba doesn't come all the way up to the bottom of Israel.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that area was where Edom was, and right now, I don't know what people groups are there.
They're mingled, I suppose.
They're all just mingled, yeah. They're all just wiped out. Islam wiped them out. Okay, completely changed it. And probably Lord Balfour, when he reorganized and took over the Ottoman Empire and everything, he probably messed up everything too. So everybody was displaced. So...
There's like some kind of end-time prophecies about Edom, is there?
There is. And I'm telling you, just like Israel resurrects, so does Edom. And it's just kind of funny. Nobody, if you met anybody... 100 years ago, they says Israel's gone. Israel's scattered. There's no way Israel could ever be a nation. And there they are again. And Edom evidently is going to do the same. But there's not like a core group there still there. They're not there.
Yeah. So what you're talking about then, is it the behavior of the Edomites as opposed to bloodline? Or is it the bloodline?
No, I think it's bloodline. It's bloodline. It has to be. Now, let me make some statements here on some applications. Edom is known for the following things. Number one, it will deny Israel passage through their land during the Exodus.
So where are we?
We're in the application. I'm just going through all of those kings and those people names and stuff.
What page is that?
I'm on page 195. I don't know what page you've got. Come on, we got Canaan's influence, number capital D. And then you got application, Roman numeral 3. I may not have given you anything more. Does it just end after that? All right, let me give you some applications, all right?
Conclusion,
is it? It is in the application or conclusion. Edom is known for denying Israel passage through the land when Israel is leaving Egypt. Edom becomes a cursed, and God says that it will become a perpetual wasteland, which I believe it is now. And it is all because of their hatred and bitterness toward Israel. Obadiah's entire prophecy is against the nation of Israel. Or sorry, the nation of Edom. Even Malachi makes it clear that Edom is hated by God. Nothing good is ever written or said about Edom. Now, Edom is a type of the flesh. And I'm going to ask you, what is Edom a type of? And you better note, Edom is a type of the flesh. The New Testament views the conflict between the flesh and the spirit as the conflict between Jacob and Esau in Galatians 5. This conflict between Israel and Esau, Jacob and Esau, this is the spirit and this is the flesh in the life of the believer. They cannot get along. It's just an immense battle. Now Jacob typifies the average believer. Jacob was deceitful, manipulative, clever, and bent on advancing his own causes. And finally, he wrestles all night with the angel of God, and his heart is finally humbled, and his name is changed. Even though he may have been slow to fully believe and trust God, Jacob's heart was inclined ultimately towards the things of the Lord. But Esau's heart and his motives were perpetually set on the world. He never cared about the things that were important to God. Esau never repented to God. Esau never sought God's blessings. ever, and your flesh will never do right. Paul says, I bring myself under subjection. I make my body do what is right, because my body will never, it will only do right when it gets a reward, when it gets what it wants.
That's the first Galatians that says Jacob and Esau.
It doesn't. It just shows the flesh and the spirit in the same. My point being that the Bible gives you this contrast, this great contrast where the two, where one cannot please God, and Esau never, ever does, and never can't. And one actually, my spirit, even though it does wrong, does my spirit always do right? Is my spirit always right? No. Well, even though my spirit may do wrong, it ultimately can do right. So Jacob's a type of the nominal Christian who can excel or can fail. But Esau is a constant failure, and that's our flesh. All right? And it ends up in the 18 things that are listed, the works of the flesh are, and he lists them, those are the works of Esau. Okay? So, we will stop there, take a 5-minute break, and come back into angelology.